session number 17572, Reel 2.
Yes, one more thing.
Yes, in my sister squadron, 801, the Sea Fury squadron, were joined whilst we were out in Korea by a chap who'd just been promoted commander at that time, which actually made him senior to the squadron commander, who was a lieutenant commander. But he just finished his flying training, and this was Godfrey Place VC, who got his VC in midget submarines attacking the Tirpitz. Yeah. Well, end of the war, he left prisoner of war camp and went back under submarines and decided this was all a bit dull, and so perhaps he might try flying. And so he did flying training and actually came out to join us in glory. I mean, it was fascinating to have a VC with us anyway, but he was a very modest chap. I don't mean he wasn't strong-willed, very strong-willed, but he said when he joined 801, right, I am the junior pilot in the squadron, I've just finished flying training, I wish to be treated as a junior pilot. And which didn't quite happen, but to some extent it happened. And so we had this commander VC flying with us. And what was interesting also was that not only was he a good pilot, but he actually changed the way in which we were fighting our war, because he rapidly said on a number of things which nobody else had thought about, why don't you try doing it this way? And so he was sharp as well. And of course, by the time he'd finished a relatively short period in Korea, he went on to be a squadron commander and became a very successful aviator as well, as a great submariner.
I never knew that, because I've known of his renowned wartime exploits. What other memories do you have of that time? You know, trivial, important, whatever. Did you have any American personnel flying with you? Were there any exchange postings in those days?
No, we didn't. We went. We had this U.S. Marine carrier which used to alternate with us, and a number of the pilots. When we went back to Japan, they actually stayed and transferred to the Marine carrier, not to fly with them, but just to see what went on there. I didn't do that. I did go up to join the army at the front line on one of those occasions to see what that was like, and I was very pleased that I finished my day, each day, in a nice, comfortable carrier. And not being up on the front line.
How long did you spend with them?
Well, we were actually up at the front line for 3 days. Mm-hmm. It was quite long enough for me. Convinced me that I was right not to do my national service in the army.
Did you have many losses at that time, either from enemy action or accidents?
We had. Yes, we did have quite a lot. Mostly from enemy action. But it reached the stage where it began to worry their Lords of the Admiralty that we were losing so many, because, particularly as we were reaching the period in 1953 when the war was obviously slowly drawing to an end, and we were still losing. I think we actually lost a total of 13 aircrew during from Glory during the 6 months of the patrol there, which is a lot.
That was what, about a quarter?
I was talking about the both squadrons.
Yeah. Glory carried about 40 aircraft, didn't she?
Something like that, yes. I can't honestly remember exactly how many aircraft we had. We certainly increased the numbers of aircraft in both squadrons Sea Fury and Fireflies for the time out in Korea. But some, I mean, we had one accident when a Dragonfly Air Sea Rescue helicopter actually hit its tail rotor on the front of the island on the side of the deck and fell over the side, which was so we lost the helicopter crew, which was not very pleasant, and the helicopter as well.
Did you ever fly the Sea Fury as well, or were you confined to Fireflies?
Not from the carrier. In fact, when I first went out to join Ocean, when we arrived in Japan, Ocean was actually up on patrol, so we went down to a Commonwealth base called Iwakuni. And there were some Fireflies, some Sea Furies there, which were being kept as a pool to replace the aircraft that were lost. And so I immediately took the opportunity of leaping into a Sea Fury and finding out what a lovely airplane that was. And that really was a delight to fly. Nicest piston engine aircraft that I've ever flown. And so I did some flying in it, but not operational flying, no.
So your tour in Korea came to an end in 1953, was it? You came home?
Yep. 1953 I came home. Then I did something a little sneaky. I decided that because I was never going to fly jet airplanes with the Navy, if I volunteered to become a flying instructor, and flying instructor training is done by the RAF, of course, at Central Flying School, the RAF wouldn't know anything about the fact that I wasn't supposed to fly jets, so I would go and fly jet airplanes with them, and then I did just that.
So your short service commission had expired, had it?
Oh, no, it was an eight-year commission, yeah.
So you were still a commissioned naval officer?
Right.
And you went to the RAF base?
Yes.
You were posted there as instructor? You volunteered? What?
I volunteered to do the Central Flying School course, which is the flying instructor's course. Went off to, initially to South Cerny, where we did the basic instructing course on the Piston Provost, which was interesting because that was a new... a pretty new training aircraft at the time. In fact, as an aside, when I first arrived at South Cerny, I went to see the Wing Commander flying, and he said, "Well, you've come 2 weeks too early for the course. Would you like to go and take some leave?" And I said, "No, I'd rather stay here and fly airplanes." And so he actually let me go on to a refresher course where they were flying Harvards, and I was given my own Harvard virtually to fly, to enjoy myself with. And after flying fairly powerful piston engine aircraft, to go back to the Harvard, I found it was a real kiddie car, and yet thinking back to flying training, I thought it was a horrendous beast.
Anyhow, your course started.
Did the basic flying training on the Jet Provost, and then up to Little Risington for the Meteor. The Meteor 7, and that was my first experience of jet aircraft.
So a piston engine Provost you originally on?
It was the piston
you
Provost, yes.
Jet Provost just now.
Did I? I'm sorry.
I just wanted to clarify. Meteors at Little Risington.
Yep.
T7s.
First jet experience, and again, it's almost the same sort of thing as the initial deck landings. When you first into these jet aircraft, and the Meteor's hardly advanced by current standards, you think, gosh, I'm never going to catch up with this, because it's going so quickly that you're being left behind. But it takes no time at all for the human mind to overcome that initial feeling of that you're never going to get with it. And I love the Meteor. And I used to fly around at high altitude in the Meteor 7, which is unpressurized. and get the occasional slight bend, but I never had any high altitude problems. It was a little worry in the back of my mind, of course, because I'd been told you should never fly at high altitude at all. But I also reckoned that because we were the first course to do these decompression tests, that really they'd taken it a little bit too far. And I think I know that the decompression tests that they do now are nothing like so difficult as the ones we did then.
When you say that you experienced a recurrence of your bends problem flying a meteor, I mean, what was that? If you climbed too quickly to altitude, or what?
Oh, this was usually after being at altitude for quite a long time. You'd just feel a pain, not a crippling pain, but a pain in one of the joints, usually an elbow joint. I used to feel these bends. You could clear it immediately by descending, or sometimes you're doing a long cross-country exercise, and you just put up with it until.
And when you say high altitude, what are you talking about? 30,000, something like that?
Oh no, this was 36,000 feet, I think. We used to cruise around that.
So that's quite an altitude without yes. Pressurization.
But then when we were doing the spinning test, we used to go up to 42,000 feet and do spinning from there. And that wasn't a problem, because it was really spending a long time at altitude that you begin to feel the bends appearing.
So that course qualified you as an instructor?
Yes.
And from there you went where?
I went initially to Leon Solent, to a squadron there which was a multi-purpose training squadron. It was doing conversion flying onto light twin aircraft. We had a great variety of Firefly, Sea Fury, Sea Hornet, the Expediter Oxford. And so, as I say, it was doing all kinds of little instructing jobs. One of the tasks which I was given, which I found absolutely of great interest, was taking pilots who'd been rejected by squadrons for various reasons and assessing them to decide whether they were what ought to happen to them next. Now, the attitude initially was when they came from a fighter squadron to put them onto something like the Firefly, which I felt was entirely wrong, because if they were unsafe on fighter aircraft, they were going to be just as unsafe on what might be a slower aircraft. But and that meant that you had then two people to think about, the pilot and an observer in the back, not just the pilot. If a chap was going to kill himself on an aircraft, I felt he was going to, my attitude was he shouldn't be flying with us at all. There was also the question of whether to put them on to communications aircraft. Again, that worried me a little. Okay, if it was just because a pilot wasn't going to kill himself but wasn't able to keep up with the intensive flying, then perhaps communications would be fit for him. But the thought of flying lots of passengers with somebody who wasn't a very good pilot, again, I disagreed with.
But were your disagreements listened to, or do you feel that
I think so, yes. I can't remember when I'd assessed a pilot and put that in, anybody ever coming back and saying, you're quite wrong there. So I guess that happened. But that was only for a relatively short period of time, and then we started doing jet training up at Lossiemouth on the Vampire Trainer. And so I went and joined 738 Squadron at the time, who were doing the initial jet conversion training. And then that was the first time that all the pilots coming through on to go on to fighters were being converted en masse and then going on to initially the attacker, but then the Seahawk came in quite quickly as well. So I was one of the jet instructors there. And then in 54 I went down to RAF Valley, where we were starting jet training at an earlier stage on the Vampire trainer, not converting pilots who were already trained, but doing the pilots who'd just done the first bit of piston engine flying, taking them onto the Vampire and taking them up to wing standard.
You enjoyed instructing men, did you?
Yes and no. I enjoyed the flying immensely, and I found quite a lot of satisfaction as an instructor. I never really felt that I was cut out to be a flying instructor. It wasn't what I really wanted to do. But
you didn't go back to carrier operations at all in this time?
No, I didn't.
In fact, was Glory your one and only carrier?
Yes, it was.
Now, after instructing you, am I jumping too far ahead?
No,
you got involved with the Buccaneer, did you?
Long way ahead.
Yeah.
I joined an outfit called the. It became called the Standards Flight. It was a small examining flight, which was intended to check on flying standards around the Fleet Air Arm, and make sure that everybody kept up to scratch and improve standards wherever we could. And it was just a small team, four of us, and we used to spend our time going around the stations trapping people. The trappers is the slang term for this team, which again was very interesting, because we got to know virtually everybody in the Fleet Air Arm at that time, and the RMVRA squadrons were going, and so we used to go off at weekends and trap them. They were very worried about being examined, because there was a slight sort of cowboy attitude amongst some of the squadrons, anyway, in the RNVR.
What were the typical irregularities you sorted out? I mean, were flying standards slipping in places? And what were the typical targets for your entrapment?
That's a question I'm struggling to answer. I suppose instrument flying was an area which we concentrated on quite a lot, because that was something obviously very important and something that a lot of pilots would let slip. But it's surprising, perhaps not surprising, but very intriguing how you can sit with a pilot and very quickly notice the way he's doing things, whether he's doing it not necessarily correctly, but in a way which is going to help him to fly properly or not. And I found that both during my instructing time and examining time, even without actually flying the airplane myself, I learned an awful lot about flying from watching the way the other pilots fly their airplanes.
Because all deck landings are filmed, weren't they? So you could study those, I suppose.
Yes. Wasn't part of our...
It wasn't.
...our task to look at deck landings as such.
Did you do a lot of flying yourselves, just to keep your own hands in?
Oh, yes.
Did you do a lot of deck landings? You flew the current aircraft, the Seahawk and things like that?
Yes. I used to fly... every aircraft that I could, because of the enjoyment of flying different airplanes and seeing how they operate. I got some very interesting aircraft at that time, like the some of the RNVR Air Squadron was still flying the Avenger, and so I flew airplanes like the Grumman Avenger. I nearly flew the Wyvern. I actually got checked out in the Wyvern, and the squadron commander then chickened out and said, "No, I don't think you ought to fly it after all." He thought his head might roll for some reason. Yes. But during all this time, certainly during my instructing time, and in particular during examining time, what I was looking to do was to do the test pilot's course and start test flying, because I reckon that was going to teach me an awful lot about airplanes. Instructing as such, you learn a lot, but I wanted to fly more, and I wanted to learn a lot more about what made these airplanes tick.
Yeah. So you went to the Empire Test Pilot School,
right,
at Boscombe.
At Farnborough.
At Farnborough, still, yes.
Yep.
That was when?
That was 1958. enjoyed that course immensely. It's a tremendous course. You do get an awful lot of very good flying. You certainly learn a lot about airplanes. And you've got a great big mix of pilots from countries all over the world as well. And so you're swapping experiences all the time.
And there's a lot of ground school as well, isn't there? Theory and so on.
Yeah.
You need to. I remember the BBC series they did on it some years ago, which was it struck me as being very demanding.
Yes, I think possibly more so now than it was then, or not that it was easy then, but. We didn't have all the detail of weapon systems, which are obviously of immense importance nowadays. Weapon system on aircraft then were quite straightforward.
And you had everything, four engine down to single, I suppose, did you?
Yep. And helicopters as well, which was something new.
Now, you were still a serving naval officer at this time?
Yes, I was.
Yeah.
Yes, I actually extended my 8-year commission to a 12-year commission, and then at the end of my time at Empire Test Pilot School, I stayed on at Farnborough in armament and weapons flight, and started doing armament development of all sorts.
Principally on naval aircraft? Or
no. Known, not principally on naval aircraft, but the interesting thing is we had some aircraft like the Scimitar on the flight, and that immediately became mine because I was wearing a nice dark blue uniform.
It's a very nice aeroplane by all accounts.
Yes. The one we had was a little bit of a rogue. It was a prototype Scimitar, which didn't fly quite right, and it was only after another year or so flying it that it was due for an overhaul, and they found inside the tailplane main bearing was a little piece of what appeared to be a metal rule. I don't know how that got in there, but I wonder if it was a bit notchy on on the longitudinal control.
And you met the lightning there, I suppose?
No.
You didn't?
No. I met the lightning when I moved up to RAE Bedford. Yeah, this is slightly jumping the gun. During my time at Farnborough, I was coming towards the end of my commission. I was looking around for test flying jobs in industry, and there wasn't anything very much going at all at that time. I mean, I was offered jobs with aviation traders to fly the accountant. You remember that one? Yes, that's right.
Lane, yeah.
Yes, and so I decided that I would take a permanent commission, which I got. But during the same time, just after I'd got the permanent commission, a chap called Dennis Taylor, who was flying as a civilian pilot at Bedford in aerodynamics flight, became Short's chief test pilot. And so I knew Dennis quite well, and he said, why don't you go for my job? So I went for, I applied to go to RAE Bedford. I mean, aerodynamics flight has got the most interesting flying in the world, I think. And moved up there, still wearing Navy uniform. I was offered a job as the civilian Ministry of Defence, or Ministry of Supply it was then, a test pilot. Since it was at about the same salary I was already getting, it was a non-established post, so no pension at all. And they offered an increment of £100 a year to this salary. I thought, this is crazy. I mean, I'm better off to stay as a naval officer. And in fact, that's what happened. I stayed on. They disestablished the civilian post then. And I did 3.5 very happy years with Aeroflight at Bedford, flying an immense variety of experimental aircraft, well, experimental and normal aircraft, doing all kinds of...
Which types in particular?
Well, I mean, the aircraft that we had in the flight at the time were the Fairey FD-2, Avro 707, Short SB-5. Handy Page 115 came in whilst I was there, as did the Hunting 126 jet flap aircraft. We had a Hunter 6, a couple of Meteors, a couple of helicopters. We had part use of a Comet and a Vulcan, which we shared with the Blind Land Experimental Unit. There was also the VSTOL research was being done there, and the Short SC-1, Hawker 1127, were both in Aeroflight. Neither of which I managed to fly at the time for various unfortunate reasons. I'll detail them very briefly. Short SC-1, it didn't fly very often because it was quite a complex little aircraft, and so we had to restrict the flying on it. I reached the point where I was about to fly it. I was all ready to fly it and all the work for it, and the chap who was OC flying there, who in fact was another naval officer, a chap called Pat Chilton, he came along to the flight commander and said, you're keeping me out of the SC-1, I'm going to fly it next. And so he pulled rank on me, and he did his conversion, which meant I never got around to doing it. Hawker 1127, we had prototype. Oh, hello, Pamela, Jerry Giesler.
And then the 1127.
Yep.
Right.
Okay, we had 1127 prototype, XB-831, in the flight. That dogs want to join in as well. I was next to convert to that, but it was off with Hawker Siddeley's doing a refurbishment. When it was due to come back to the flight, Hawkers asked if they could hold on to it for a bit so that Bill Bedford could fly it at the Paris Air Show.
Oh, yes.
And that was the time when one of the motors ran away and tilted the nozzles when he didn't want them tilted, right in front of the president, which I was watching as well. And I was very pleased that it was Bill Bedford flying that aircraft and not me, because I don't think I'd have pulled it off the way he did.